converts from an alcoholic?
Yes.
Is this thing on? Okay. You guys have a lot of eyes. My sobriety date is January 15th, 2007. My home group is TYPG here in Tampa. It's Tampa Young People's Group, or when I'm in Tokyo, it's Tokyo Young People's Group. So either way, my home group is TYPG. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others. I kind of say those things as I start out. I don't say my sobriety date to brag or anything. It just shows new people that this thing works. I remember my first week in sobriety. I was like 4 or 5 days sober, and my sponsor told me to go up and pick up a white chip. And I was like, what? I got 4 or 5 days now. You know, you're selling me short. You know, and he's like, no, it's not for you. It's to show the new guy that this works. You know, and that's pretty much all I am, is I'm up here as an example to show new people that this thing works. And I believe with my heart and soul today it works. One thing that I noticed was that a couple weeks ago, I was standing around with a group of people that I've known since I got sober, you know, almost five years ago. And they were all here in 2007, 2008 when I was getting sober. And we were all here about 6 o'clock before the meeting started getting things set up. And I just noticed looking around at these guys that, you know, they're all still doing the same stuff. You know, they're all still sponsoring other people and being sponsored. They're all making the home group important. They show up early for the home group. They do service, you know, things like that. And those are the three most important things to me, you know, sponsorship, home group, service. That's the only reason why I'm still here, you know, because I do those things. And I noticed that trend in the friends that I've made since 2007 is that they do that stuff too. And they stick around year after year and they're still here, you know, and that's why I think AA works. When I keep those three things important, AA works. I guess I'll just tell you guys what it was like. I grew up in a military family. My parents were both Army officers, and I was an only child. I feel like Dr. Bob says in the Big Book that as an only child, it engendered a lot of the selfishness that played a big part in bringing about my alcoholism. And I was spoiled. I was spoiled rotten growing up. And I can remember always feeling kind of... I remember feeling distinctly awkward when I moved from... we lived in Germany overseas when I was growing up, and then we moved to Tampa, Florida, or here. And I remember distinctly when I moved here that I felt awkward. I started junior high school. First of all, I started junior high school. I was going to school in the States for the first time, and I just felt so uncomfortable in my own skin. I just felt very awkward in social situations, especially around girls. And I was a fish out of water in any kind of situation that involved talking to other people, you know. And I really felt uncomfortable, you know. And I really identify with I think it was Ralph White that says, you know, I'm trapped in what I think you think of me. I've lived with that my whole life. I've never heard it said better than that. You know, I'm trapped in what I think you think of me. You know, and I've lived with that. You know, and I remember my junior year in high school was when I drank for the first time. I don't remember, you know, when I first took a sip of my dad's beer or anything like that. But I definitely remember my first time getting drunk, and it was at like your typical coming of age party, and it was at a little high school party, and they were drinking, they were taking shots in the kitchen, and I went in there. And I started taking shots too, you know, and I figured, you know, I don't know. I wasn't really prepared for anything, but I figured I would know how to do it, like, automatically, you know. And I remember taking, like, 3 or 4 shots, and I don't remember coming up for the first time. Like, I remember going right into a blackout after those 4 shots. And when I came out of the blackout, I felt better than I'd ever felt in my entire life. Like, all that tension, that social tension that was building up over the years was just completely gone, you know. And I felt like everybody was my friend automatically, you know. I could just talk to people. And I remember I drove a couple people to the party, and there was no way I could drive in the condition I was in after that. But I remember being down on my knees. This girl was like crying because she had no way to get home, or just being emotional or whatever. And I remember getting down on my knees, and I was like, everything's gonna be all right. Don't you see that everything's gonna be all right? And for some reason, one time I made a connection later in college when I was experimenting with all kinds of drugs and stuff. And I would drink alcohol, I would look online, and I would look up the side effects of drugs and stuff like that, or whatever new drug I was trying that week or whatever. And I would always be interested in like people's like stories of what it felt like to do that drug, or what it felt like to do this. And out of curiosity, I looked up alcohol. And I remember one thing that hit me really hard was when I looked up one case of alcohol, how alcohol makes you feel, and euphoric sensation and stuff like that. And it said the feeling or sensation that everything is going to be all right. And more than anything else, that's what alcohol gave me. The feeling or sense that everything is going to be okay. And I remember being, and I connected that sometime with my first drunk, being down on my knees in front of that girl, being like, don't you see that everything's going to be all right? Like, and just trying to convince her of that, you know, because I felt it. It was like pumping through my veins, you know, that sensation, you know. And everything seemed to stem from that. Like, I had all this self-confidence. I could talk to girls all of a sudden, you know, and they were laughing. I don't know if they were laughing at me or with me, but they were laughing, you know. And that was better than before when I couldn't even talk to them. And, you know, I felt like James Bond when I was drunk. Just like James Bond, you know. He's always, like, in the hotel room with the unbuttoned tux, and he's got, like, a bottle of vodka, you know, and the pistol under his pillow. And I just felt like that, you know. I don't know, like, how I looked on the outside, but I felt like that on the inside, you know. And it worked. Alcohol worked for me. And, but, you know, it, like it says in the big book, in Bill's story, you know, and gradually things got worse. You know, gradually, so gradually that I couldn't even notice it as it was happening. You know, I mean, at first, I've heard people say at first it's like drinking and it's all fun, and then it's fun with problems, and then it's just problems. And my fun with problems was pretty long. You know, I had my fun stage was really long. It lasted about 3 years where I didn't really seem to get a lot. Well, maybe I did, but the alcohol worked so well that I didn't notice, you know, because everything was going to be all right, right? You know, and I'm still to this day learning some of the stuff I did in that stage when I thought everything was all right. But still today, I just came into town. I talked to one of my old buddies from back then. And he told me about a time when I wet myself in my bed that I didn't even remember. I had no idea. I was blacked out and I didn't even know I'd done that. And he said he told me about it the next day and I still didn't remember. And I was shocked to hear that, you know, like, oh my God, how could I do such a thing? Like, it seems like so long ago, but that's where I go, you know, that's what I do. And here I am thinking I'm James Bond, I'm out wetting myself, you know, in front of my friend. And, you know, that's the difference between what my perception is and what other people's perception was of me. And so, anyway, I things started to get bad. Things got worse eventually. I got in trouble with the law. I got my license taken away for 6 months. I was worrying my parents and my friends at times, and I always noticed that, you know, even at the very beginning, I was kind of not like a heavy drinker, and I knew I wasn't a normal drinker, of course, but I knew I always took it a little bit farther than my friends took it. You know, I never wanted to leave a party. I always noticed that people would leave parties, like they would come and stay for about an hour and, like, you know, do some drugs or drink or whatever, and then leave. And be like, why are you leaving? This is the place where the alcohol and drugs are. You're like, there's no other place to go, you know? Like, and like, I would always be the last one there. Like, everybody else would be passed out or in other rooms or whatever, but I would be the last one from the very beginning. I drank before work. Probably my third time drunk, I drank before work. I mean, work sucked, and I figure if you're drunk for work, it would be better, you know? It would go faster, and it did, you know? So I would drink before work often. I would drink in the morning. I intuitively knew that if you had a hangover and you drank, you would feel better. So I did that a lot. And, you know, I didn't see any problem with it. I just figured one day I'll assert my will and I'll be able to control this. It'll go away. And what happened was I started to worry people, and I decided to join the U.S. Navy because I figured that would make everybody proud of me and get, you know, kind of get the heat off, you know, because that's, I think, what we alcoholics do when things start to get troubled. We make a decision or go somewhere to make people stop worrying about us or to get the attention off. And that's what I did. I joined the ROTC program at USF, and, you know, my drinking escalated this whole time, you know. Like, I was supposed to be, like, an executive officer in charge of our, like, cadet battalion and, like, showing up and disciplining their guys. I mean, I was second in command of, like, you know, like, a lot of ROTC students, and I would just get drunk and, like, not show up. I would just, like, call in. Like, it was the same stuff I was supposed to be disciplining people for, and I would just get blackout drunk and be like, sorry, I can't make it today, you know, like, I'll deal with the consequences tomorrow was kind of my mentality, you know. I would just be like, I'll deal with it when I'm tomorrow, but for now I'm going to get good and drunk. And I did that a lot, you know, and I have no idea how the Navy let me in, but I did a lot of things that should have gotten me kicked out before that. So I joined, I graduated from college. I had pretty good grades despite my drinking, and I joined the Navy. And one thing that happened when I joined the Navy was that my private life immediately became very public, because I was on a ship and I was in front of people all the time. You know, in college, I could kind of do whatever I wanted and, you know, black out sometimes and do very humiliating, you know, embarrassing things and just, you know, stuff that skeleton in my closet and nobody would ever know about it, you know. But in the Navy, like, everybody was, their eyes were on me because I was a young naval officer. All the enlisted guys, all the people drank in the same places, so I was blacking out and causing troubles, like, right from the start. And I was only in the Navy, like, a month before they were like, you got to go to rehab, dude. And, I blacked out and I did some things I'm not proud of. And, you know, I woke up the next day and my head was pounding so bad and everybody was just, like, looking down and embarrassed. And my boss called me into his office and he was like, do you know what you did last night? And just started chewing me out. And he was like, you got to go to the the drug and alcohol prevention officer and tell her that you need help if you want to look good in the eyes of the captain. And so I did that. And for some reason, I didn't really tell the truth with him, but with the counselor, for some reason, I told the truth. I mean, this is probably divine intervention. But for whatever reason, I told the truth about how my drinking was escalating. I told him how I used to drink, you know. I remember when I first started drinking, I could drink 2 or 4 drinks and get drunk off that, you know, when I was like 16. And now I was drinking, you know, 10 plus to even feel anything. And I told him about my tolerance is increasing and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, yeah, you got alcohol dependency. You need to go to rehab, blah, blah, blah. And so they signed me up for rehab in January, which was going to be in – I was in Japan. I was stationed in Japan at the time. And they said, you got to go to rehab here in Yokosuka in January. And I blacked out again in between then. And they were like, you got to go to rehab now. You know, and it was like – so then we got back into port from wherever the port visit was where I blacked out again. And I went to San Diego and I went to rehab. And I did really good in rehab. Like, I didn't stay sober. Like, rehab, the stuff I learned in rehab didn't keep me sober. I was introduced to AA meetings, but to be honest with you, I mean, like, I was popular in rehab. For certain, I guess I was a really young officer, and there was, like, a lot of grizzled old chiefs and stuff like that, and older guys, enlisted guys, and, like, I was, like, a mascot for them for some reason. They were always pushing me out. They were like, you should do it, dude, and, like, and cheering me on, and, like, I was like, yeah, I'll get involved in rehab, you know, and so I was like, I felt like I did rehab really well. You know, I did everything they told me to do. I wrote in a little journal, and, like, I told them I had problems with my self-esteem because I knew I was really not confident. And when I drank, I had all kinds of self-esteem. And I was like, if I just had self-esteem, I wouldn't drink is what my feeling was at the time. So the guy gave me all kinds of, like, self-esteem boosting techniques. Like, he's like, stand in front of a mirror and tell yourself 5 good things about yourself a day. So I'm, like, in front of the mirror, like, I'm sexy, you know, like, stuff like that. And, like, I got to be honest, I didn't keep at it. You know, like, I don't know if I would have kept at that, my self-esteem would improve and I would have stopped drinking. So I can't, like, honestly say that route doesn't work. But I felt really stupid doing it. So I quit, you know, like, so I, like, it was like, it, like, wasn't working for me. So, like, I stopped doing it, you know. So I guess I didn't do rehab 100%. I left rehab. Actually, also in rehab, we played softball a few times. We had a great time doing it. And at the end, we voted somebody most likely to stay sober. And I won. I was, like, so impressed. I got this softball signed by all the guys in my rehab class saying stay sober. It's still in my closet at home here in Tampa, actually. And hang on to that. It's kind of faded. You can't really see much of it anymore. But you can still make out a couple things like, stay sober, man, and stuff like that. And, like, so I was really proud of that. And I got out of rehab and I went out. We immediately went on a port call. I didn't have any kind of aftercare program or anything like that. Or if I did, it was in port. And we went immediately underway. We went to a port and went out to party with my friends, you know. But I wasn't going to drink. My plan after rehab was a year without drinking. And from the time I left the Navy to the time I got sober in AA, my deal was if I just stay sober for 1 year, my tolerance will go down. And I confirmed this with my Navy buddies. They all told me that would work. If I stay sober for a year, my alcohol tolerance will go down, and I'll be able to drink like a regular. I'll be able to drink like I was 16 when I could drink. My feeling was I can get drunk really quick and really easily and have fun again, because that's what happened when I was 16. And so if my tolerance goes down, I'll drink 2 drinks, get drunk, it'll be fun again. It didn't work, you know, because I couldn't stay sober for a year, first of all. And no matter how long I stayed sober, what I didn't know and what I learned later in AA is that no matter how long I stay sober, if I start drinking again, in a very short period of time, I will be back where I was if I wouldn't have stopped at all. And that happens to me every time. My experience has proved that every time. And that scares the heck out of me now at almost 5 years sober. Because I was bad when I got here. And I know where I'm headed if I start drinking. You know, and I believe what the big book says about the guy 25 years sober, dead in 4 years. You know, that could happen to me. No doubt. So I got to keep on watch, you know. And so anyway, but at the time, you know, I was convinced. And all the Navy buddies, heavy drinkers in the Navy confirmed it. That if you just stop for a while, you'd be all right. So what I did was I kept trying to stop, and I was drunk 3 days out of rehab. You know, as soon as we went out of that party, they were passing around like I was drinking glass after glass of water, man. I must have drank like 3 gallons of water. And finally, the liquor came around one time, and I was like, yep, fill me up. You know, I just couldn't take it. They just weren't partying like they're supposed to, you know. Like, it just, there was too much wrong with the world, you know. And I drank, you know, I drank like I always do. And then I was like, all right, the year started. And the very next morning, my buddies were like, dude, we can't hang out with you. You're going to get us in trouble. And so the first night I went back to drinking, I was already in trouble again. You know, as gradually things got worse. And, you know, I just kept thinking, you know, all right, the year starts now. You know, and then I made it till up about Christmas time, and I was like, all right, the year starts now. You know, and I drank again, and I was like, oh, screw it. You know, and then I just started drinking. And then, I lost control, and just, like, I binged again. And I got kicked out of the Navy. And my experience is just like it talks about in There's a Solution, where it says, he often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. You know, I had warning signs, like I lost my license. And then, I joined the Navy to get the heat on my back. I got in trouble in ROTC. Then I go to rehab, you know. I kept getting these slaps on the wrist, and I was like, all right, I'll clean up my act, you know. I kept trying to clean up my act, and each time, I would slowly get back, and then I would crash again. And then I would slowly get back, and I would crash again. I would slowly get back, and that's my drinking career. You know, I would start to get things back together, and then just pull the structure down my head by a senseless series of sprees. And as my drinking went on, the time that I was able to stay sober, the time that I was able to build back up got less and less and less. And, you know, it was like every time, it was getting bad. You know, and my binges were getting longer. My blackouts were getting longer. And, it was so subtle, you know. And when I came to AA and they talked about faith and I didn't understand what it meant, you know, like one analogy I always use is that faith I had in alcohol at the time when I think about my second step, you know, is that even when alcohol wasn't working, I believed when I was sober that it was going to take me where I wanted to go. You know, that's a powerful example of faith. You know, I had faith in alcohol like there's like no other, you know, and I try to apply that same kind of, I try to remember that whenever I think about my second step. You know, because I was just convinced that, you know, it's going to be good again this time. And no matter how many times, you know, how bad things were, I have like an internal forgetter. I just forget how bad it gets over a certain period of time. I heal up, I rest up, and I think this time it'll be different. And it never was. It never was. I always got back to where I was, and I always embarrassed myself and did, you know, pitiful, incomprehensible, and demoralizing things. And, you know, so I got kicked out of the Navy. I came back home. I was working at Publix as a stock clerk. Where I was, you know, making, you know, $60,000 a year as a brand new officer in the Navy. And I was like, it's all right, I'll go back to college. You know, I started to build things back up again. I was going to go back to college and, you know, get an international business degree and keep learning Japanese and go back over there. And I couldn't keep my job at Publix. I got drunk at work too much and I blacked out and crashed my car. And, you know, I remember blacking out the last night of my drinking. I remember the last day of my drinking. I woke up in the morning, my best friend had slapped me in the face the night before, I remember that, and then being in a blackout and waking up behind the wheel of my car, and just, I had to drink, you know, I just had to, it was like involuntary, I drove straight to the convenience store to get a drink, and that night, you know, I blacked out, I couldn't stop drinking, you know, and I was driving my car all over the road, and people were calling the police left and right, and there was all kinds of police reports, I read about it later, that were crazy, and I woke up in the drunk tank. And I was strapped, I was beaten on the glass, like yelling at the police officers, and they came in and strapped me down to this chair, and I was screaming. And I just remember thinking, like, when I was sitting in that chair, I was remember thinking, you know, like 6 months ago, I was a naval officer fighting for my country's freedom, and now my country is taking my freedom away. And I remember I made that connection, and I was just like, wow, this is not going to stop. You know, this is, you got to do something. Just this in gut feeling, like, it's going to get bad. It's going to get much worse, you know. And the thing that scared me more than anything else and brought me into AA scared on my knees was I didn't think I was going to end up killing myself. I thought I was going to drive and kill somebody else. You know, there's the part when it talks about the real alcoholic in the big book, it says he is dangerously antisocial. And I could not be, my circle of friends was getting less and less and less. It was dwindling to the point where I could only hang out with people who drank like I drank. And that was getting to be, you know, fewer and fewer. And nobody wanted to hang out with me. So I couldn't hang out with my friends. I couldn't go to their house. I couldn't be seen in public because I'd black out and embarrass myself, so I wasn't at bars or anything. And I couldn't drink in front of my parents because they were worried sick about me, and it just broke my heart to drink in front of them like that. And so I was driving around drinking, just driving, you know, or parking in places and drinking and then driving. And that's what I was dangerously antisocial. You know, I was an unguided missile just going down the highways, you know. And my feeling was that I was going to end up killing somebody else, and I'd have to live with that. And that was too much for me. So that's what really brought me into AA. Scared, you know, because I knew that was going to happen eventually. And, you know, I came into AA because I remember when I went to San Diego, I didn't really listen much, but I knew that was where people were staying sober for long periods of time. The people that were coming up and saying they had long-term sobriety and stuff like that. And that's the only place I'd really seen people doing sobriety for long periods of time that worked, you know. And so I came to AA, you know, and I didn't know what to do. You know, I was scared and in a new place and confused, and I just, you know, I was willing to listen to anybody, you know, and I'm really glad that I came to this group, this home group, where people wanted to sponsor, where people wanted to do service, where people were enthusiastic about sobriety, you know, and having a good time sober, you know, because that was one of my biggest hang-ups before I got to AA was I thought I was never going to have a good time again, you know, but my experience has been that that's not true. You know, it's like it's the beginning of a new life. It's not the end of my life. And Like I remember when I was brand new in sobriety, this guy talking about Ikipa, and I think he was talking about Ikipa in New Orleans. It was the year before I got sober that that happened. And he was talking about how it was so great. He was like, 5,000 people walking down the streets in New Orleans, sober. And he looked at me for dramatic effect, you know, and I was just like, I was thinking in my head, I was like, that's kind of lame, man. Like, that's not cool. You know, like, how am I supposed to be impressed? Like, I don't, you know, like, but then I went to Ikipa in LA the year I got sober, and I had the time of my life. You know, he proved me wrong. It was so awesome. It was just like a whole hotel of people partying. I've never been on a party that scale when I was drinking, but in sobriety, my first year, we partied like that, you know. And it was great. I needed that. I needed to be around sober people that were partying like that when I was in my first year. And I was glad to be a part of that. And we were doing service all the time, you know. But anyway, when I first got here, I just stuck my hand. Somebody stuck their hand out to me. And, you know, he just took me into the meeting and sat me down and talked to me, you know, and paid attention to me because I was new. And I remember going outside after the meeting and another guy walking up to me. And I said, well, I know I need to get this sponsor, but I don't know what to do about a sponsor and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, just ask, man. Just ask. And I'm so glad he got me like that, you know, because I wanted to think about it and like get like a drill sergeant or a Mr. Miyagi type that was going to like look at me and know what's wrong with me instantly and tell me to do cool stuff like walk across a bamboo pole or something and like get real spiritual, you know, automatically, you know. But like, I'm just glad that I didn't have time to sit around and think and look around and use my brain to decide. This guy just asked, you know, and I did. And the most important part about that was he wanted to sponsor me. You know, that's everyone in the world is not like that. You know, I know that now. But I didn't know that at the time, and I'm so glad that the people that the guy that sponsored me at the time of my sobriety was enthusiastic about it, you know. And I called him that first night, and, you know, I was just like, I didn't know anything about the sober way of life. I was like, can I still play video games? Can I, like, do this? Can I do that? And I was asking him all kinds of questions. He's like, yeah, just go to the Sunday night, make sure you meet me at the Sunday night meeting, and come back next week, the Thursday night, and make Tampa Bay Young People's Group your home group. And I remember I felt something at that exact moment, like I was a part of, you know? And because, I mean, like, I was kind of nervous about coming down here. It said Hyde Park, and it was in Tampa, and I was like, young people's, it's probably going to be, like, all clicky and stuff, and I'm not going to be able to fit in, and I'm really nervous about it, and they're going to be, like, real cool urban kids, and I'm not. I'm a suburban military brat, you know? And, like, oh, I was going in my head about that kind of stuff, and I was in, like, the first night, you know? All I got to do is say, hey, I'm an alcoholic, and they're like, you're in, dude, you know? Like, it was great, you know? And, like, I remember feeling, like, relieved, like, when he told me that. Like, yeah, dude, you're, you know, just come back, make it your home group. You know, and we just started right into the steps, you know? And there was a lot of buzz. I remember there was a lot of buzz about the steps and the importance of the steps, and you got to work the steps and your fourth step, you know? Fourth step is real tough. You got to do that. And, you know, there's like people always talking about that kind of stuff and sponsorship and things like that, you know. So I guess that I wanted to be liked, so I started on my steps, you know. And I my first step, you know, I did a powerlessness and unmanageable list. And on one side, I put times when I felt powerless over alcohol. And on the unmanageable side, I put how that made my life unmanageable. And I'm glad, you know, in the fourth step, and my sponsor made me write some things down, because in my head, I have like an instant eraser, you know. Like, I can rationalize things. Even when I read it off the paper, I just write down the facts. Even if I read it off the paper, I try to rationalize it to my sponsor, you know. But it's there, you know. When it's in print, I can't change it so instantly, you know. But when I'm reading off the paper, it's like, oh, the reason why I did that was, you know, it was, you know, that's why I did that, you know. But, like, you can't change it when it's on paper. So I'm glad, you know, in AA we make lists and stuff like that, and we find out the real problem, you know. And the second step, you know, like I already talked about, like, I remember talking to my sponsor. I've never been really religious or anything, and I didn't really know anything about God or religion or spirituality or anything like that. But we read the part in the Big Book, you know, where Bill is talking to Ebby, and he just says, you know, he says, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. Willing to believe. All my sponsor said was, you got to try. You know, you don't have to believe in anything, but you got to be willing to. You know, that was a real revelation for me. That all I had to do was be willing to believe. You know, and that worked. You know, because I was like, all right, I'll just try this. You know, have you ever prayed? And I was like, no. All you got to do is try. You know, try to pray. So you know, when I first started praying, all I did was get down on my knees and I just tried. You know, the action was all I needed to start doing. You know, there was nothing really to think about. Or I was always under the impression with religion and stuff, I had to learn something or some kind of secret knowledge or something like that, but it's all in the action. You know, it's all in, you know, you got to start praying every day. And, you know, that was where my second step started, you know. And one thing about the steps is most of them were delayed reactions to me. They, When I did them, I didn't feel an instant change. I don't really remember doing any of the steps and feeling like, you know, I always wanted to walk out of it doing, when I walked out of my fifth step, I wanted to walk out like feeling like I'm walking on water, like I feel great, there's the light, and I'm cured, you know? And it never really happened that way for me. What the steps are really like for me is like, I'm going to use a naval example because of my naval career, but it's like a small course change for me. In the Navy, like, my job as a conning officer was to make sure the boat stays on a straight course. Because if you're only 1 degree off, in a long period of time, you'll end up in a completely different place down the road. And the steps were like that. When I started taking these steps, they're like small course changes. Because I wouldn't really notice anything right away. Like, if you're only 1 degree course change, right away, you're never really going to notice the difference. But way down the road, that one course change turns into a great distance. You know, and that's what the steps feel like to me. Because looking back on it, you know, because I didn't feel anything the first time I took them. I just kept taking the action, you know, showing up for the home group, doing service, sticking around people doing the same things as me, listening to other people's experiences, reading the big book, doing stuff like that, making this thing important. And that's another thing that I'm glad my sponsor told me very early on in sobriety. That I think it was that first night when I called him, and he was like, if you keep AA first, everything else will work out. You know, and that's been true. When AA is number one in my life, everything goes pretty smooth. When AA takes a back seat to something, that's when things start to get rough. And, you know, I'm so glad he told me that. And I still tell newcomers the first night they ask me to sponsor them, I tell them right away, you know, if you keep AA first, this thing will work out. You know, but when other things start to take precedence, that's when things get rocky. And that was really important for me, you know. So I stuck with the crowd. You know, I stuck with the crowd and I went to the places they went. And I worked the steps with the aid of a sponsor, you know. And I think that's a huge reason why I'm still here today, you know. So, you know, I worked through my steps. I did my fourth and my fifth step. Like I said, I wanted to walk out there feeling perfect. And, like, for example, with my fifth step, you know, when I walked out my fifth step, I felt worse. Like, seeing all that stuff on paper and telling another human being the horrible things that I did that I was never going to tell anybody, I felt, you know, pretty bad because I realized what a crappy person I've been and I saw my part, you know. And that made me feel bad. But the time when I felt like I was really feeling the fifth step promises, you know, where you can look the world in the eye and stuff like that, is later I was working with other guys on their fifth step, you know. And when I did my fifth step with my sponsor, like, everybody was like, yeah, when you do it, your sponsor would be like, oh yeah, I did that too, and stuff like that. And mine didn't really do that, like, as much as I would. He probably did, but, like, not as much as I hoped, you know. I was hoping the whole time he'd be like, yeah, you're not that bad, dude, but he didn't really say that, you know. And I was like, oh man, maybe I am bad, you know, maybe I am worse than everybody else, you know. And then when I heard somebody else's fifth step, and I heard what they had to say, you know, and I just realized we're all kind of afraid of the same things here, you know. And I just got this great feeling, like, it's going to be all right, you know. And the fear just kind of bled out of me when I heard other dudes' fifth steps. The turning around and passing this thing on to another alcoholic is so important. The other side of the sponsor, not just being sponsored, but also sponsoring someone else. And I highly recommend that if you've never had that experience, you've been in AA for a while, if you've been in and out or something like that, if you've never sponsored somebody, you've got to do it. You've got to do it before you get out of here. Because that is the most powerful part of my sobriety, probably, is sponsoring other guys, trying to sponsor other guys, or sponsoring other guys, you know. And like, my first week of sobriety, I remember my sponsor coming and picking me up for meetings, you know. He's picking me up for meetings in this crappy, or not, sorry. And this, he had this broken down car with like three donuts on, or no, it was, only had one donut, I think, at the time. But he would drive from Tampa to pick me up in Riverview and then drive me all the way down to St. Pete, like, the first night he picked me up. And my mom would be like, ask him if he needs gas money or something like that. Help him out, you know. And, or like, I would try to give him gas money and he would be like, no, it's all right, man. Just do it for the next guy. You know, and if you could sum up my sobriety, you know, my AA work, it's just that, you know, just do it for the next guy, you know. And, you know, 6 months later, I got my license back, but I had to blow into this like, doohickey that you have to hum as you blow and to start your car, you know. And it was really embarrassing. People were all, like, trying to make me laugh while I was doing it. I was like, stop, guys, it's hard, you know. Like, and, like, so I had to get the hang of that. And, like, I was driving people around, like, blowing into my little, you know, blow device. I forgot what you call them, the sobriety device or whatever. Breathalyzer, yeah, interlock device, that's it. And you know, so I'm picking up guys and taking them meetings, and they'd be asking me, do you want gas money? And I knew intuitively what to say, you know, just do it for the next guy, you know. And it just came right out, you know. And it's great, you know. I lived out in Brandon, so I would always be taking car rides into Tampa to go to Tampa Young People's Group and stuff like that. And that was great, getting sober, you know, because they talk about the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting, and that was powerful, you know. I highly recommend you show up to meetings early. and you stay late. You go to fellowship. You stick. You get car rides. And that was important for me when I was getting sober. And I was lucky to be out in Riverview also, because after I had about 90 days and I'd worked through my steps, my sponsor was like, every time I called my sponsor with a problem, he would be like, "Who are you helping? Are you sponsoring anybody yet? Are you sponsoring anybody yet?" And he would urge me to pass this thing on, you know. And I started sponsoring people around, you know, a little after 90 days. And it was cool because I had a monopoly on it, because, like I said, I lived out in Riverview. So anybody who came from Riverview, they was like, "Oh, I live next door, dude. You know, you need a sponsor?" Yeah, so it was like really easy for me to get anybody who came from the Riverview Brandon area, and so I would get like a monopoly on them, and I'd work with them. I just got 10 more minutes somehow. Where was I? Oh yeah, I got a monopoly on the guys from Riverview and Brandon, and you know, it was. You really threw me off with that 10-minute thing. Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. So anyway, I'm sponsoring guys, and you know, what did I do next? I sponsored them. They didn't. Not all of them stayed sober, but you know, I was staying sober. You know, and it was really important for me to have those long car rides. Even I actually started sponsoring guys before I got the car back with the interlock device. So I would have my grandmother would take me to meetings, and I'd still be getting rides for my grandmother and my mother, and like have a sponsee in the back seat, you know, talking to them while my grandma's there. But it's good because my grandmother is actually 31 years sober in AA, so it worked out. And you know, that long time before the meeting, long time after the meeting, forging those relationships was really a big part of my sobriety. And I don't know how long I was sober, maybe like almost, it was almost a year. And I started a meeting out in Brandon. We call it the Brandon Young People's Group, you know, and we had it on Friday nights the night after. And the people from this home group came out and supported it. You know, I'd ask a different person every week to come out and speak there. And, you know, the people in Brandon were like, "Oh, this is great, AA," you know, and loving it and stuff. And new guys came to that meeting that are still sober today. You know, starting that meeting got people sober that are still sober today. That's an awesome thing to see, you know, and the meeting didn't last. You know, I left town and it changed to something else, and everybody's like, "Oh, it sucks now. You don't want to go down there." And but there are still people sober from that experience. You know, me trying to carry the message like helped other people, and like I can see it now. You know, and that's so awesome to be a part of. You know, and now I live in Tokyo, and I moved over to Japan about a year and a half sober. I prayed before I went, and I got the job, so I went. And you know, everybody told me moving in sobriety is hard, you know, and they're going to do AA differently, and you're not going to like it, you know, and all these warnings like that. And I was like, "I'll handle it," you know. I was always like, "I got it, you know, it'll be no problem. I'll just do what I did here," you know. And I went over there, and AA wasn't the same, and I was like, "This sucks," you know. Like, I was so, like against the meetings over there, and, like, there was a lot of, like, turmoil between the groups about new AA and, like, the way they've done it for years and stuff like that, and it was really hard to get used to, but I'm glad I'm a part of that, you know. I'm glad I got to be a part of that. And you know, I sponsored. It was weird. I lived just outside of Tokyo when I moved there, and a new young guy moved into town. He was like the only guy around my age in the whole town. He was brand new sober, he was like a few days sober. He relapsed on the plane over. He had like a day sobriety when I met him, and he lived on the same. There was like 50, 60 train lines. Curve all around Tokyo, probably more. And this guy lived on the same train line as me, going inside and outside of Tokyo. The weird thing about that was I prayed to God to put a new guy in my life right around that time that happened. And it was weird that a new guy moved into town on the same train line as me going into Tokyo. And then, like, new guys saved me. Because, like, every time I get to the point where I'm just, like, I'm just fed up with AA. Or just, like, you know, I just, like, I got this. Or, like, something is, like, when I was 90 days sober, I remember. I did 90 and 90, because you know how you hear that all the time, 90 and 90. That works. And so I figured after 90 and 90, I'll just go to two meetings a week, the home group and the Sunday night, and then I'll be good. It'll be like a little club I go to on the side, and my real life will be out there. And, you know, I remember my 92nd day, I started sponsoring that guy that I started sponsoring just after 90 days. And I was getting ready to, I was lifting weights in my garage or something like that, and it was like the first night I was going to skip a meeting after 90 and 90, you know. And I wasn't going to go to the meeting that night. I was just going to stay home and relax. And I got a call as soon as I started to go lift weights. And it was my sponsee. And he was like, "Are you going to a meeting tonight?" And you know, that guy didn't stay. But like that clinched moment, you know, that could have been the difference between me standing here right now and not making it to another meeting. You know, I'm so glad that I started trying to carry the message, you know, because that made all the difference, you know. And the same thing happened again when I was out in Tokyo. I was, you know, I don't know what, I wasn't going to go to a meeting one night. But he's on the same train line. So how can I tell my sponsee to, like, I'll wave as you drive by on the train, dude, you know, like, it just doesn't work, you know, like, and, you know, I feel like a lot like Dr. Bob talks about in, you know, Dr. Bob's Nightmare, the four reasons why he carries on the message, you know, is a sense of duty, you know, is that my sponsor, you know, I was sitting in an AA meeting one time getting that same feeling, and some guy said, there were people here for me when I was dying. You know, and it hit me. You know, like no matter how well I get, there's someone out there that's not, you know, that could use my experience, strength, and hope. You know, I'm uniquely useful in a way that nobody else is to the alcoholic because I've been there. You know, so I need to be there for that guy. Two, it is a pleasure. You know, I had some biggest parties I've ever been to have been in sobriety. You know, and some of the things I've done in sobriety have just been amazing. You know, I've seen such amazing things and been all over the world now in sobriety, and it just keeps getting better, you know. Three, because in so doing, I'm paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. You know, just do it for the next guy. That's the only requirement. You know, some people say, oh, you don't got to pay anything back or whatever this guy wants you, but I disagree. I think, you know, the requirement that I lay down to my sponsee is just do this for the next guy. You know, and four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And like I said, those clinch moments that were like I was not going to go to a meeting tonight, and then all of a sudden, phone's ringing. It's like clockwork, you know, and it just seemed to work out that way. Wow. I really got a bonus there. So I kind of skipped around a bit. My third step is a real important part of my sobriety. I love talking about the third step. I get a lot from a lot of my inspiration from Sandy Beach. He lives here in this area, and I actually like when he says, "If things aren't going your way, stop having a way." I love those simple little quotes we have in AA. You know, just like when things aren't going your way. I remember I was around 9 months sober, and up until that point, things had gone pretty smooth. And I was hanging out with people in AA, and something happened that didn't go my way for the first time that I really wanted to go my way. Like, and I was really, like, upset about it, and I was letting everybody around me know about it. I was just miserable to be around. Everybody was miserable with me, you know. And, I just really wanted something to happen that it didn't go through my way. And I was pretty upset about it, and I remember I pouted for a little while and was upset for a little while. And then I was sitting outside a meeting with my buddy, and I remember him saying, I was just complaining about something. He was like, if things aren't going your way, stop having a way. And something just clicked when he said that. Like I felt the third step really, really come true in my life. You know, I'd read it and I'd worked it with a sponsor, but there's just moments later on when things just click for me, like when they start to make sense in a whole new way. And I look back and read the Big Book and it makes sense in a whole new light. You know, the Big Book changes like almost every time I read it because of my experiences. Like the first time I read it, I could identify with all the drinking and the stuff in there, the solution in chapter 3. But I couldn't get all the spiritual angles. You know, I couldn't really understand because it'd never happened for me. But the longer I stay sober and the more I work around AA, the more I come back and I read the Big Book and I'm like, wow, that's happening. Wow, that makes sense now. You know, wow, those things start to come true in my life. You know, and they're really important for me. My favorite part of the Big Book is when it says, when Bill's talking about his spiritual experience and he says, "For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And so it had been ever since, how blind I had been." You know, worldly clamors. You know, I was around the same time that 9 months I was sober, right around the time I had a year, I was sitting, we had these meditation meetings weekly. And I didn't know anything about meditation or anything, so I was really glad they had that guided meditation thing because I didn't know how to meditate, and I didn't know what it involved or anything. But they had this guided meditation that was like easy mode for people who don't know how to meditate, you know. And so I went to it, and I was participating in it, going there every week, just trying to enhance my spiritual life. And I felt like I had a spiritual experience. Like the third time I went, and I suddenly got this after I walked out of there, I just got this burst of energy, you know, and like the spiritual stuff in the big book really started to make sense to me. And it was just like something really clicked. My second step really clicked. A power greater than myself kept running through my head. And I was like, if it's greater than myself, it's greater than my thoughts. It's greater than anything I ever thought or ever think. And something went through me like this. I just got this great feeling like things were going to be all right. And it gave me all this energy and a strong desire to pass this thing on. And ever since that happened, I truly believe that, you know, this is a daily program, and then if I don't maintain this thing, I will go back to where I came from. But things have been different since that happened to me. Something deep inside me. I can lose sight of that by worldly clamors, but I definitely think that something changed that day. And I don't think it was the mechanics of the meditation, or you have to go to meditation meetings for that to happen to you, but I think it was everything I was doing in AA at the time. My whole life was AA at the time. And, you know, that was the most important thing for me, you know, and that was when that big revelation happened for me. And, you know, after that, I just caught fire. You know, I caught fire with AA. And I was listening to speaker tapes. I got, like, Sandy Beach's 12-step, 12-disc collection. I was just riding around, just bumping that everywhere I went, you know, and just, like, just fired up about AA everywhere I went, you know. And I was really into spirituality and stuff like that, and I was on fire, you know. And when I was like that, you know, it was very easy to carry the message because I was very excited about this thing, and it seemed to draw people to me. And before I knew it, I was sponsoring, like, three guys. You know, and those guys helped me stay sober and helped that feeling last, you know. And I'm just, I think it's everything that I was doing around this group, you know, everything that you guys do around here. And I owe that to you guys, you know. I heard a guy talk about it once, and I really identified with it. It makes sense to me. He said, you know, some people talk about AA being like the side thing, and then the real world is out there. You know, they say like the real world is out there, and this is like on the side or whatever. But for me, sometimes, this is the real world. That's on the side. Like, I get dressed up like this for you guys, for AA, you know. This is the main event for me, you know. Like, there's nothing bigger than this. This is where I go, you know, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, 5 to 7 times a week back in Tokyo is AA. You know, that's the main event. You know, that's the stuff that I get from what I do in here. So as far as I'm concerned, this is the real deal, you know. And you guys taught me that. Thanks for letting me share.